I had been to the camps before. I'd been to Calais. I'd worked in the camp there and in other camps. And I, that did not prepare me for what I saw in Lebanon, in Tripoli in particular, you know, in the surrounds of Tripoli. It was really horrific. And I suppose the worst thing about that is that I always feel when I go to Calais that the people are visible. And sometimes that's not a good thing because they're out there in the open, you know. But, and then the workers, you know, who I volunteer with, go out and talk to them and meet them. In Lebanon, they're away in these houses, unfinished kind of ghost estates, in unfinished buildings. Nobody knows they're there. And they look that way. Like the colour is all grey. It's the same colour as the unfinished cement in the house because they're terrified to move outside a 1 kilometer radius of where they live for fear of being picked up and sent back.
And when you say that, it's the fear of being sent back to Syria.
Yeah. Or you know, being caught with no papers. All they're really frightened.
How many people are we talking about, Eileen, in Lebanon? How many Syrians?
Well, they say there's 1.5 million, you know, and UNHCR say that there are 750,000, which would be half of that. But you see, people are afraid to register with UNHCR as well.
Why is that?
Well, they don't feel protected by them, do you know? I think a lot of the time they feel betrayed. And I'm not saying that that's totally true, because obviously UNHCR do a job and they obviously give food vouchers or different things. They also subsidise health payments, but they don't pay the full thing for anybody. And the health charges are unbelievable. They're unbelievably high. So that means that they can't even go to a public hospital because they're too frightened, because usually they're not living. All these places are way out, you know. So even how they would get there would be a problem, but even if they could get there, they wouldn't go. So they would go to a private clinic, of which there are more small clinics, and they charge even more than the hospitals. And then UNHCR don't pay that because it's private. They're all traumatised, and, you know, the ones who have family with them feel very lucky. Do you know, one house I visited, and it was a main room and maybe two little rooms off it, and then this kitchen that they took me into. And like, there were five families now. There were obviously brothers, sisters, married, you know, all the couples stood there, and they had three special needs children, Down syndrome children, three little girls, you know, maybe 2, 4 and 6, and a whole lot of other children. And they were all living in, I suppose we'd call it squalor. And they obviously had fled, and I guess I couldn't speak to them, but my feeling was that they felt quite lucky because at least they had each other and they were all safe so far.
Did the people that you meet, did they feel safe about going back? Would they be encouraged to go back, as we hear discussed in the media at the moment?
No. I mean, the whole reason that I went was to support people who might be threatened to go back, because the Access Centre for Human Rights had done a report, and they had traced several cases of people who had been forcibly repatriated. And in each case, they found that it wasn't okay for the people. And when we went to the UNHCR and the country missions and the EU offices and the American embassy, I mean, we brought this up. That was why we went. And yeah, like, I would say most of the country missions were very sympathetic to the case. UNHCR were a bit in denial. You know, they even said, well, oh, that they were present at some of these repatriations and the young men wanted to go. And that is not true. None of the young men want to go back and join the army and be forced into the army. That's, you know, nobody else would report that. UNHCR, interestingly, when the whole idea a couple of years ago of repatriation started to be talked about, they wrote down 10 conditions that they would feel would be safe for people to go back, and until that they wouldn't be recommending return until those conditions were met. And when they put that out, the Lebanese government threatened then not to renew the visas of the UNHCR staff. So immediately they withdrew the document, and they've never pushed anything since.
How do the Syrians feel they're treated by the Lebanese?
Well, they feel they're treated abysmally by the authorities. I mean, ordinary people day to day can be very sympathetic to them. Of course, because there was a war between the two countries before, there's a bit of begrudgery there and everything. But ordinary people who are, I suppose the poorer people are quite accepting as well. You know, we're kind of brothers in this together. A couple of the people working on the delegation are Lebanese, and they're totally open to the Syrian people and feel they should have rights. So, you know, I think it's more the people in authority and the government and all the corruption around the money and that sent.
What struck you once you started to meet and talk to people? What were the stories they told you?
Well, part of the delegation were committed Syrian people who have now, well, you know, a couple of them, one in Turkey, one in Paris, one has decided to stay in Bekaa Valley. You know, that's his choice. He could actually go somewhere else. I should name him, really. His name is Dr. Fadi. And, like, he obviously looks for funding all the time, and people let him down. One year he gets it, the next year he doesn't. He has a real positive view, and he rises above everything. And, you know, I was just saying to somebody recently, even in the school and in the education centre and the clinics, everything is, it's a pleasure to be there. And that is so important for the people, because, you know, the people are in the school situation, for a school I went to, it's a container, a couple of containers together that he's transformed into a school. And he's done it so nicely and artistically. And, you know, the people come out of their tents and they come in there to a space that's nice, and they have trees going around the little square and nothing elaborate, but really pleasant. And he has a library for the children. And even the library is done in a really creative way. It's not just straight shelves. They're all, you know, children, the way children would like them. X's and O's with the books filled in and all that. And he runs a reading competition. I'm just giving that as an example of how it lifts the children to come into that space. And like someone like him is so committed, you know, they work 7 days a week. I'm not saying he's on every minute of every day, but the school is open. He employs the teachers who are qualified teachers, and that's all running. What he said was, well, you know, I have to hold this. This is my gift. I could really go to America tomorrow if I wanted, but because he has actually a Syrian passport still, and he has a visa for the States. And the reason he has a visa for the States is another really interesting thing, is that in 2016, he took his Syrian robotic team. They make robots in the center, and they won the robotic championship, whatever it's called, competition in America. So like that was a big thing for him. And that has now, they have, instead of calling it the Syrian robotic team, they're calling it the refugee robotic team, because they want to represent all refugees. So it's almost like having a country named refugee, you know, because everybody else is represented by their state or their country.
So this must have a very positive effect on the students.
Yeah, very. And this year, the really interesting thing is that two girls have joined the team.
It must have been very difficult to see the lives of so many Syrians upended because of the war. Did you get a real sense of that just from being there?
Yeah, well, you know, inside those centres and then the health centre, if I didn't know, you could think that's anywhere. You know, there's just people in a clinic waiting. I mean, actually, the queues weren't as long as some of the queues in Dublin because it's so well run and organised. But you know, then even in town in Beirut, the children are all working from six upwards. They're on the street selling tissues or whatever. They'll never see school, well, as far as I can see, because there isn't any way for them to. And there's really horrific scenes of special needs children in wheelchairs and the parents pushing them around all day and they're starving. And, you know, so it is everywhere around one when you're in Lebanon. If there's 1.5 million, they have to be somewhere. In contrast to what I experienced in Bekaa Valley, then I went to volunteer in Tripoli, outside Tripoli, the next day for an organization called RAMA. And we put together some packs for children, and I visited the warehouse. And I thought the warehouse would be full of clothes and things because the winter is coming, and blankets and things people would need, or food, you know. But that was naivety, because actually there was nothing there, practically nothing, a few bits and pieces, nothing. And then we went out to the families to distribute the school packs, and what we met was unbelievable. Hardship, even beyond hardship, really, was terrible. A lot of the people were living in different unfinished houses, unfinished kind of what we would call ghost estates. Do you know, the top of a house that is only half finished, there's nobody living in it, and wires hanging down everywhere, water running down through the wires, unsafe. They don't have furniture, they don't have, you know, a mattress on the floor, maybe, if they're lucky. And the interesting thing is, a woman in the first three houses, I hadn't copped it, you know, I was the only woman. So there were three men and my companion, who was also male. He was American, who had come on the delegation. And we all walked in and we gave the gifts to the children. And then the women were nudging me and asking me to go to the kitchen. So I went to the kitchen and I looked and, you know, said hello or whatever. And then I walked out. And then it struck me, after the third one, why they were asking me, because there was nothing in the kitchen. Nothing. You know, they had no fridges anyway. And there was no food at all, which really shocked me, that you know, I imagined that there would be rice or flour or something there. And obviously that's what they wanted to show me. And like, really, when I looked in their faces, then after that, I knew what was wrong. I mean, they're just unbelievable that they can keep existing day after day and live in those circumstances and not know where the next grain of rice is going to come from. It's beyond belief. An uplifting memory was one of the schools I visited. Again, that was in Becca Valley. And this woman who is, she's one of the wives of one of the disappeared. And she actually had been on the bus in England the time they toured, but she hasn't got a word of English at all. And she's a really beautiful woman. And her school shows that even though the building, like, they've done their best with it, it's really bursting at the seams with all these little children. And she's like the playground. She's really tried to make it attractive and all that. And she had hens. She told them to tell me that she tried to have hens, but the hens ran across the road and got killed. But when we were leaving her school, we were walking out to the car that we came in, and she walked ahead, and then she said, she showed us the flower bed, and she said the children always work in the flower bed, and they, you know, they have herbs mixed in with the flowers so that they can bring them home and taste them. And she said, then she bent down and she pulled a rose, and she turned around and she gave me the rose.